Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 12th, 2015. Today, we're pleased to be joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Great, D.R. Good to have you aboard. So, D.R., in the past week or so, President Obama has taken a historic step of rejecting the Keystone Pipeline. And for those of you who perhaps haven't caught up with it, the Keystone Pipeline was going to cross the American border up in Canada. It required a presidential approval. The Keystone Pipeline was very dirty energy and a precedent and all kinds of bad things. And climate activists finally pressured the president into rejecting it. Right? You saw that, DR.
Yes, it was a great speech that President Obama delivered on November the 6th, aired on much of the broadcast and cable networks, and Obama basically laid out the multiple cases against the pipeline, basically saying that it was not needed for an economic stimulus, basically saying it would do nothing to drive down oil prices and most importantly, would sabotage all the progress that the United States had made in addressing climate change. As Ed Markey noted, Senator Ed Markey noted in an appearance on PBS NewsHour after the decision was made, the United States cannot preach temperance from a bar stool. It can't run around telling India and China that they got to cut their own emissions while the United States allows something that will increase emissions. So basically, Obama declared that, you know, this cannot go through and that furthermore, in order to show real leadership on climate change, a certain percentage of fossil fuel has to be kept in the ground. So, that was probably the most important, the most resonant aspect of the speech, the fact that Obama, I believe for the first time, has you know, referenced the keep it in the ground rhetoric and the keep it in the ground movement.
Well, I think that there is, you know, we've talked a lot about distant causes and proximate causes here on this show. I mean, the fact that President Obama ended up in the White House announcing that he was going to kill what would otherwise have been a routine pipeline project really does bespeak something remarkable underneath it. And the reality is that President Obama was forced to deal with the Keystone XL pipeline because of opposition from the climate movement. And those of you who have been listening in, and if you haven't, there were enormous protests down in D.C. They had 50,000 people on a frozen day a couple of years ago. There's been continuous pressure, not just in Washington, but across Nebraska. And the bottom line is that in this instance, activism worked. So the big question I'd like to think about a little bit today is the question is, what has the climate movement learned? How are we different having done the Keystone, you know, picked up the Keystone XL project, so to speak, opposed it, and ultimately won, right? That's a almost a watershed for our movement, right? Would you agree?
Absolutely, and as you note, it does demonstrate that activism works, and also demonstrates that conventional wisdom doesn't work. That everybody who arrogantly assumed that the project would be approved, they're all left basically eating crow and wiping the egg off their faces, because what they did not understand, what they did not comprehend, is that, you know, people who were committed to stopping this, they would never say die, they would never quit, they would never give up. They're just going to keep going and going and going until they got the result they wanted. Right. It just shows you the power of having a resolute spirit and never throwing in the towel.
So there were two articles that I saw that did a nice job of summing up to my, or at least, well, I mean, I think it was a nice job. They summed up. I found them satisfying articles. One was from a guy named Ben Adler, who writes over at Grist. And his article is about basically titled, "The Fight Against Keystone XL Changed the Climate Movement, and Here's How." So I just, in case you haven't seen that article, and they're interesting discussion points, Mr. Adler goes through a list of things that are now different because of the Keystone XL pipeline movement. The first is that climate activists have a focus now, right? We've become, over the last 2 or 3 years, much more focused on these large extractive projects, right? And that gives the movement something to talk about. It gives people a real, literally a focus to, for all their efforts to coalesce around. And you see that now across the board. I mean, the people out in Portland that were opposing the Shell, you know, drilling, the Arctic drilling, right? Yep. And there are many pipelines across the country that are being opposed by local people who are just sort of awake, you know, have been focused by the Keystone XL pipeline. Another big attribute that the Keystone XL pipeline brought to the climate movement was diversity, in the yes. sense that if you may not have been paying attention back in the day, but there was a anti-Keystone demonstration in Washington that was called the Cowboys and Indians March, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where
yes.
people from Nebraska, Native Americans, ranchers, all went to D.C. to say they didn't want this stuff going through their land. And mm-hmm. that kind of diversity of drivers for the opposition to the pipeline was mm-hmm. a new thing, right? And all of a sudden, you've met new people, you've built new alliances, right?
Yes, there were multiple arguments against the pipeline, and a diverse coalition came together to make those arguments, arguments involving eminent domain, arguments involving damage to the Ogallala Aquifer, and also damage to the climate, damage to the environment. So
mm-hmm.
it became
mm-hmm.
just a broad, broad coalition that had a powerful cultural and political impact.
Exactly. And then the next thing that Adler says that the Keystone XL movement has given, has bequeathed to the climate movement, is training. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of people now, a lot of people who have been arrested, have made the journey to Washington, have gone and made themselves a Keystone XL sign. And that kind of training is invaluable, right? Because now all those people go back out into their communities and they've done it once and they know how to do it again, right?
Exactly. It's sort of like the civil rights movement, how you had broad banding together against to push for national civil rights, and then people would go into their own local communities and push for civil rights leadership and civil rights changes mm-hmm. in their own communities. So you see how things go from national to local, and how this will expand what I believe Bill McKibben called the Keystonization of protest against fossil fuel projects, what
uh-huh.
Naomi Klein calls blockadia, basically.
Yes, absolutely. So then, I mean, there's a very interesting article that Mr. Adler's written, because I had not been through all these things, but he maintains that one of the things that climate hawks have learned from the Keystone XL experience is the value of pressuring your own friendly politicians, essentially
mm-hmm.
assertiveness. I mean, many climate hawks, myself among them, are so grateful to have, you know, a halfway sane person in office, and that Jim Imhoff is not our president, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you know, your guy gets a pass. But in the Keystone XL project, you know, friendly but firm pressure was applied to President Obama, and he responded, right?
Mm-hmm. It goes back to something Tom Hartman said about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that when Franklin Roosevelt became president, he was not this sort of bold, progressive leader. He basically just wanted to be sort of like a technocrat. He just wanted to sort of, you know, manage the economy and try to help America get through tough times. But it was only because of citizen pressure and citizen activism that he began to take bold, progressive stances in terms of economics and social policy.
Mm-hmm.
And and remember that famous line attributed to FDR, where he met with a bunch of labor activists and he said something to the effect of, "I want to do it and I agree it should be done, but now you have to make me do it."
Right.
And you can imagine just, you know, decades later, Obama saying the same thing, that he had to have known what the risks were, but he needed the political cover. He needed a political forcing to make him do it.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened here.
And so, given the fact that climate hawks were assertive here, and they won, that translates into political clout, according to
mm-hmm.
Mr. Adler, right? All of a sudden, you know, you win one, success breeds success. And so
exactly.
people proceed to other topics with a feeling of confidence, and the people that I mean, we'll go on to, into this in other topics in some detail, but I think the fossil fuel industry in general is smarting a little bit. Is they're not happy that they lost, right? And that's a lesson off for them that they can lose, and a lesson to climate hawks that they can win. And then
Exactly.
the last point that he made is how the Keystone opposition made climate hawks somewhat more media savvy, in the sense of, getting a nice narrative, a story, right? There was a through line. It was, we couldn't. It was the end game for climate. There were real bad guys. There was the TransCanada were the bad guys. The good guys were literally the cowboys and Indians, right? And so that management of the media in a good story, was something else that the movement has learned how to do, right?
Exactly. And it's going to be the movement that's going to continue, gaining strength and gathering strength. I believe Bill McKibben is saying that the next thing that the climate movement needs to focus on is making sure that ExxonMobil is held legally accountable for its defrauding of the American people in the late 80s and early 1990s. And there are going to be other major fights. I think Bill McKibben wrote a piece in The Guardian saying that we something to the effect of we scored one touchdown in a game that we're still losing. And obviously, you want to make sure that you ultimately end up scoring the winning points, because if you lose, everybody loses.
So anyway, that's the Adler article. Then the other one was from our hero, Mr. Dave Roberts over at Vox now. He put up an interesting piece about basically under the premise of, what people did not understand about the Keystone XL opposition movement. And if people who may not have been paying as much attention will may they have to think back, but at the beginning, when this was first, the Keystone XL opposition first was growing, many serious bona fide climate activists who consider themselves very smart were complaining that Keystone was the wrong target, right? Do you remember any of that, DR?
Yes, and the David Roberts piece just seemed to it just struck me as one long, very amusing, and very hard back of the hand given to the likes of Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine and Joe Nocera of the New York Times, both of whom demonized opponents of the Keystone XL pipeline. And David Roberts made the point that the strategists and the activists against the pipeline knew exactly what they were doing, knew exactly what kind of strategy they were trying to execute, knew exactly that the goal was to sort of delegitimize the fossil fuel industry, to take away power away from the fossil fuel industry, and to return power to the people, if you will. And that all these people, who just spat upon and gave a thumbs down to the KXL
Keystone.
opponents, were basically proven to be the fools that they were, because those activists won and won big.
Well, and I guess I would be a little more gentle in saying the people, there were bona fide sort of environment climate wonks who are focused on emissions reductions, right? And I think one of the things that Roberts is saying is that, I mean, that's all well and good, but an activist movement is different from what the wonks need to do. And to your very point, that the climate is not an environmental issue, it is a cultural issue. It is something that needs to be attacked symbolically and at many levels, and that's what essentially the Keystone Project did. It attacked at a symbolic level and won at a symbolic level. And to your point about the delegitimization, it's true. I mean, Roberts writes that until now, a fossil fuel based answer has been the default, right? You got a problem, you need electricity. Okay, you build a coal plant, right? That's that. But now, because of Keystone XL, that's not the default anymore. We've delegitimized that, and that can only grow going forward, right? And
Exactly. It goes to something Ed Schultz said about how, it proves that the oil industry is not going to win all the time. There are going to be times when they lose, and this comes on the heels of another loss, which is the decision involving Shell, no, basically pulling out of the Chukchi Sea, and then Obama canceling the oil leases for that region. So again, you have two back-to-back losses for an industry that's used to winning and winning easily.
And then Roberts goes on to talk about the fact that, or at least, refer to the fact that it is not the job of the climate hawk or the climate activist to have a detailed policy solution, right? It's the job of the activist is to change the culture. And in this instance, it's simply, and he uses the word, throwing sand in the gears, right? You just want to mess it up and delegitimize and be problematic for the oil industry, because that shakes things up. And then you know, all the wonks will come along with, you know, a detailed policy solution. But in the interim, it's the activists that have to change the culture.
And that's what Bill McKibben has noted in multiple media appearances. They said that while the activists were pushing back against Keystone XL, the price of solar dropped, the price of wind dropped, the price of renewables overall dropped, and that therefore market forces basically made the tar sands uneconomical, essentially.
And so since you mentioned Bill McKibben, we ought to close on at least my personal feeling is that again, for those who've been paying attention, this may be old news, but if you weren't paying attention in the beginning, Bill McKibben, and of course he's the leader or was the leader of the 350.org organization. I mean, he was a lonely figure calling out the Keystone XL pipeline, and he was the one that was taking the flack for choosing the wrong target. Right? And if he hadn't spoken up, Keystone XL would have been built, and we would have missed that symbolic opportunity. And so I think after all this, you know, all this talk, Bill McKibben needs to be recognized as a far-sighted climate hero. Right? We got to give credit where credit is due.
Although to follow up on something I'd criticized Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks for, obviously McKibben wasn't the only guy leading the charge. You had Jane Klebb of Bold Nebraska, you had Julia Trigg Crawford,
who
was also an activist against the pipeline, and also we have to credit the person from whom I first heard about this issue 4 years ago, which is ironically not Bill McKibben, but Jim Hansen, because it was Jim Hansen who in June of 2011 issued that statement. He wrote, I think it was an op-ed, in which he basically said, if you let this go through, it's game over for the planet. And it was Hansen that basically called for, I don't think he called for climate activists at the time, but he did specifically call upon the climate science community to sort of rise up and basically say hell no to this project, and everything sort of grew from there.
Well, I tell you, as climate hawks, we can be proud and happy that we won the Keystone XL pipeline, and we need to take that on to the next, right? We're halfway through the first quarter of the football game. We're behind a couple touchdowns. We scored one. Now we got to keep building that momentum, right?
Exactly.
Use an exhausting sports metaphor. So we got to leave it there, DR. Good thing Keystone did us. We learned a lot. We'll tell our listeners that they can check out links to most of what we talked about here at the MCAN blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog. Please go leave a comment. Tell us where you're from, how you found the blog, how you found the podcast. And, of course, there's a donation pay button there. You can be proud to donate to MCAN. You can find us also on Facebook at /massclimateaction. Please share us. You can like us and then share us. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You can find us on iTunes. So, DR, we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.